All right, thank you, Eli. And I wanted to credit Eli for all the efforts that she made to pull together this panel and pull together this very distinguished panel. And she's really done a lot of work behind the scenes. So appreciate your efforts, Eli. So I'll be talking about a little bit about systems approaches to the obesity epidemic, and give an example of how we're using a systems methodology to address some of the issues. So first of all, I want to credit our VPOP team. So VPOP stands for Virtual Populations for Obesity Prevention. I'll explain what that means in a short bit. It rhymes with K-pop. So I wanted to credit Adiv, Sean Brown, Ray Ferguson, Joel Gittleson, Daniel Hertenstein, Eli, of course, Claudia, Michelle, and Elijah. They really are the engine behind the our modeling efforts in our Global Obesity Prevention Center. So first of all, most of you know that obesity has become a global epidemic. This is no longer a problem that's restricted specifically to a particular set of countries or particular income levels or particular age groups. It's really become a worldwide problem, affecting all age groups, affecting all income levels, and has tremendous impact, not just on chronic diseases, but with psychological impacts, sociological impacts, etc. So I probably don't need to convince all of you that this is a major worldwide problem. And one of the continuing issues is there's been no shortage of interventions and policies that have attempted to curb the obesity epidemic. But we haven't seen any sustainable solutions. And we've seen situations where certain policies or interventions may have momentary effects, but none of these have been sustainable. And one of the reasons is that obesity really results from a complex system of systems. So we use this graphic to show some of the factors and relationships that are impacting diet and physical activity. So of course, many of you know that biology plays a factor. So of course there's some genetic predispositions, but we've found that genetic causes really account for only a small percentage of the obesity epidemic. And then we have behavioral factors. So behavioral factors that affect diet as well as physical activity, but these don't work in isolation. They're also affected by social influences, by the environment. So when I say environment, I mean food environment as well as physical activity environment, cultural cues and cultural influences, economics, and policy factors. And these are just a few categories that affect the obesity epidemic. So when we say a system, what do we mean by system? Well, each of us doesn't exist as isolated islands. We actually exist in a system of different factors and relationships. So a system is any type of collection of parts or components that are interrelated, that don't behave or act independently, but really depend on each other. So we depend on the social systems, political systems, environmental systems, and economic systems that we live in. And so therefore, it's important to use a systems approach when trying to understand something like the obesity epidemic, and also when trying to design and develop and implement different policies and interventions. So what are the dangers of not using a systems approach or not accounting for the systems that are causing obesity? Well, first, you develop band-aids rather than solutions. So we've seen many of these situations where you're developing particular interventions and policies that seem to smooth over particular signs or symptoms for a short bit. But then these are unsustainable because you really aren't fixing the engine that's beneath all of this. And when you don't use a systems approach, many times you can miss secondary and tertiary effects. So it's almost like tweaking an engine and then not looking at what the impact might be. And some of these effects may be beneficial or positive effects. So you're actually underestimating the benefits of a particular intervention or policy. But some of these may be negative and lead to unintended consequences. So there are many examples of very well-meaning policies and interventions that actually have unintended consequences or negative consequences. So some examples are, for instance, if you were taking a school or trying to ban junk food in vending machines in the school, well, that might actually push students out to the penumbra around the school so that they're purchasing, making the same food purchases, but outside the school. So you're losing opportunities to actually intervene in other means. And as a result, many times you expend time, effort, and resources through trial and error. So if you don't really understand the system, you start poking at the system and trying different things, and that results in a lot of wasted time, effort, and resources. So there's a need for a system science approach. So hopefully I've convinced all of you of that. So there are many other types of complex systems in the world, in nature, as well as in technology. Transportation systems, manufacturing systems, financial systems, ecological systems, etc. And many of these systems have been transformed, or many of these industries and professions have been transformed by new systems approaches. So think of weather, for instance, meteorology. Prior to using systems approaches, prior to understanding how everything fits together, a lot of the approaches for meteorology have been very much guesswork and disconnected attempts. So looking at the moon, the sky, the stars, how the cows are doing, and trying to guess whether it's going to rain or snow tomorrow. So we feel that using a systems approach can really transform obesity prevention and control, just like it has transformed other types of fields. So one of the techniques or methodologies used for systems approaches or systems methods is computational modeling. So when I say computational modeling, I don't mean on the what's displayed on the left, I mean what's displayed on the right, basically using computers to really understand or portray a system. And when I tell people that I'm a modeler, well, they look at my clothes and say, no. So modeling is really not a replacement for other types of traditional studies like clinical trials and retrospective and prospective studies. Instead, it's a bridge translation. It really can take data information from these different traditional methods and expand them or extrapolate them or help fill in some of the gaps. It can project needs or ideas to these different study designs. And I want to quickly show when we integrate modeling into systems approaches, this is not a one-time, you disappear, create a computer model, and then reappear 7 months later and say and tell everyone, oh, the answer is 7. Instead, what you do is you convene multidisciplinary teams, and that includes disciplines that are traditionally associated with the problem, like obesity, as well as disciplines that are new to the problem, bringing new perspectives. So for instance, computer science and mathematics and engineering. And together you create mathematical computational models to represent the system. And this can help elucidate important factors and relationships, guide and prioritize data collection, and test different policies and interventions. And that informs key stakeholders. And then you design and implement the interventions, you get more data, and that can help update the models, and you kind of move in the cyclical iterative process. And you basically move towards the solution. So let me give you an example of how we're doing that in Baltimore. So as I mentioned, the virtual population for obesity prevention, the VPOP labs, is basically a sim city for obesity prevention. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the computer game SimCity or SimEarth or The Sims. I think they're about 10,000 different types of SIM software applications, but we're developing a SIM city for obesity prevention. And what that is basically a computer simulation representation of a metropolitan area or a region or what have you. So we've started with Baltimore City, and Baltimore City has a population of about 620,000 people, has very high rates of overweight and obesity. And there are links between the local food environment and some of these obesity epidemic in Baltimore. So, for instance, our colleagues at the Center for Livable Future have identified a number of food deserts within Baltimore. So these are locations that have poor access to healthy food supplies. And there's a high rate of diet-related chronic diseases in Baltimore City. So our initial VPOP of Baltimore really focused on some of these food deserts. So these are low-income neighborhoods that are dominated by corner stores and carryouts with relatively few supermarkets. So we created the Baltimore Low Income Food Environment Simulation Model, otherwise it's known as BLIFE. And this was used to help decision makers test different types of policies and interventions to help improve the food environment. And we focused on the after-school food environment, because many times kids, after they leave school, they no longer have the structure and guidance of school or home, and there's that intervening period where they go to these carryouts, go to all these different corner stores, and can eat many different types of foods that may not be as healthy as they would at home in school. So we asked questions such as, how does the after-school food environment impact adolescent obesity over a period of time? How does after-school physical activity also impact obesity measures such as body mass index? So the features of the BLIFE model are, we basically have virtual representations of the households, schools, and various different key food sources in these neighborhoods. So these include convenience stores, corner stores, fast food restaurants, carryouts, and supermarkets. And we also represent different key physical activity locations, such as parks, playing fields, and recreation centers. So each adolescent within these neighborhoods is represented by a computational agent, and the agent characteristics, the agent, like real people, has a set of characteristics such as a gender, age, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, household locations, and school destinations, and heights and weights. And we use a variety of different data sources to populate and calibrate these models, including NHANES and synthetic population that we have of the entire United States. So here is the adolescent's daily schedule. So we're creating an overall model that represents each of the different meal and snacking opportunities and physical activity opportunities that an adolescent or a person has throughout the course of a day. So for instance, each agent will wake up and they can choose whether or not to have breakfast and where they have the breakfast, and then they travel to school, and that might be by walking or by car or bus, and that has implications on the amount of calories that they burn, all the way through all the different types of meals. So this initial model focused on just this window where adolescent is traveling from school and then going throughout the neighborhood, potentially exercising, potentially eating. Oops. Okay. And embedded within each computational agent is a metabolic model that was developed by Kevin Hall. So we've been working with Dr. Hall to integrate the metabolic model that he developed into each of these computational agents. And this metabolic model takes the calories in and calories out and translates that to changes in fat-free mass and fat mass, and ultimately weight and then BMI. So here's the visualization of how the model works. So as you can see, you can scroll in and out, or zoom in and out. Baltimore is right in the middle. And so he's zooming in. And so each of the different locations that I mentioned, homes, schools, and food sources and physical activity sources are represented. As you can see on the left are the different icons. So it's clicking on the different icons. And when you click on the icon, it demonstrates or shows the different characteristics of that location. And then each of those round circles that that incidentally sort of look like donuts are represent different adolescents. The blue are boys and the red are girls. And you can see they're moving about the neighborhoods from the home to the schools, and they're stopping at different food sources and different physical activity locations. And as a result of their movement, if they're walking, they're burning calories. And every time they stop at a food source and have a snack or a meal, then they're ingesting calories. So we can run the simulation, each simulated day proceeds, and then we can run this for many days or many years. And over the course of time, we can track what happens to the person's BMI. So as you can see, this next slide or this next screen shows the BMI trajectories over time. Okay. So if we ran, when we ran the model using the baseline situation in Baltimore, we found that the BMI percentile steadily increased. The BMI percentile of adolescents steadily increased over the course of 5 years. So this is due to the poor food environment that exists in many of these locations. And then what we did is we ran a variety of different types of sensitivity analyses to look at what might happen if we changed healthy food availability at these different food sources. So this shows, this x-axis is the percentage change in healthy food availability index scores. So we used a healthy food availability index, which measures the percentage of inventory that represents staple foods and healthy foods. And if we increase that, then the BMI, which is on the y-axis, decreases. And if we decrease that, the BMI increases. We also looked at things such as what's the caloric expenditure of going to rec centers. So this represents different types of physical activity classes and programs at the rec centers. So this has an impact on BMI, as well as the calories burned per mile. So if more kids are walking more vigorously, then this has an effect. And then if you have a combination of going to increasing the chance of kids going to the rec centers and then the calories burned at the rec center, that has a large effect as well. So this is just a snapshot of the different types of sensitivity analyses that we ran with this model. So in summary, we feel that a systems approach is needed to really address the obesity epidemic. And the systems approach really looks at obesity from a multi-scale perspective, incorporating all these different systems that lead to obesity. And I gave you an example of one type of systems methodology that we can use to really better understand all of these systems and design and develop different types of policies and interventions. And I've listed some of the findings from our BLife VPOP model there. So hopefully that gives you a little snapshot of a systems method and a case study of that. So I think, Eli, we're going to hold questions until the end. Yep. And so, thank you for your attention, and I'd like to pass it on to Steve.